Good morning. We're glad you're here with us. If you're visiting, welcome to Genesis. We appreciate you taking a Sunday morning to hang out and look at God's grace. We're going to be spending about 6 weeks just looking at this incredible topic that is really the core theme of the Bible, grace. The fact that we desperately need and God has given an unbelievable gift of grace. And the heart issue here is the fact that really when it comes down to it, the Bible's pretty clear as it teaches us as we interact with this great God, this God who created all that is, this God who is personal and real and he is relational, this God who is over all and in all and sovereign over everything that is and desires a relationship with us. This God interacts with us on the basis of grace. If I try to earn anything, if I try to do anything where I like meet God halfway and kind of meet him in the middle and connect with God, I end up being in a place where I no longer can really accept anything that he has to offer, because everything that is what it means to be a follower of Jesus is about grace. And so we're going to talk about this. It's like I said, probably the central theme of the entire Bible, our need for and God's incredible gift of grace. There's a passage in Ephesians chapter 2 where the writer says this: it's by grace that you are saved. It's not of yourself. It has nothing to do with you had to offer, what you had to bring to the table, but it is all of God. By grace you are saved, that not of yourself. It's a gift from God. It's not a result of our works, so that nobody can boast. And so we're going to be talking about grace and the fact that we need grace, God gives it, and how do we interact with this grace? How do we receive it for the first time? If I already am a follower of Jesus, how do I live under grace? Because I want to tell you, just as easy as it is to miss grace as somebody who's not a follower of Jesus and try to meet God halfway in the middle, sometimes those of us who've trusted Christ, we kind of come to a point of faith, but then now we're just trying to work out the way we live our lives. And that's not it either. It's all grace. It is all about God giving to us what we couldn't do. And just to kind of set this up, I want to give you two definitions that you will hear in every message. If you're here all 6 weeks, by the 6th week, you'll either be really tired of this or you'll be able to quote these, okay? And I hope it's the second. I hope that you're not like, oh, not this again, but that you're like, okay, I get this now. I get grace and I need it and I want it in my life and my life is about this now. And the first definition is this, that grace is getting what I don't deserve. It is understanding that God gives me what I don't deserve. Anything good in this life is from the grace of God, and I don't deserve any of it. That in my state, for me who I am, listen, I'm being, this is me on stage. I'm supposed to be the preacher who has it all together, and I don't. I struggle and am just as messed up as you are, and I'm really going to be honest and a little bit transparent about that this morning. I struggle, and I don't deserve anything that God does in my life. But God, just because he is a God who is merciful and loving and gracious, pours his grace into my life. And so grace is getting what I don't deserve. Now, the flip side of this, there's actually two words in the Bible. There are two sides of the same coin, the words grace and mercy. And grace is getting what I don't deserve. Mercy, and it's when I don't get what I do deserve. And so grace and mercy go hand in hand. They're the same coin, flip side. When I trusted Jesus, what really was going on is that God was pouring his grace into my life, meaning that he was pouring into me things I didn't deserve, like peace and hope and joy and just a life that was worth living. And at the same time, I deserved his judgment. I deserved to be separated from him. I deserved brokenness. But instead of that, God poured into me his mercy as well and his forgiveness. And so grace is getting what I don't deserve. The very word in the Bible, if you're studying the New Testament, you come across the word grace. It's a Greek word. The New Testament was written in the ancient Greek language. And it's a Greek word, charis. We actually have, you know, one of the our singers up here, that's her name, and it comes from the word for grace. I love it. And the word charis or grace is that which causes joy, pleasure, gratification, favor, acceptance for a kindness granted or desired. It's a benefit, thanks, a gratitude, a favor done without expectation of return. The absolute free expression of the loving kindness of God to men, finding its only motive in the bounty and benevolence of the giver. What that definition means is this: that grace really flows from the word that means joy. And God gets great joy from pouring into people's lives what they don't deserve. It means God who is over all and is broken by what our sin and even broken by our brokenness, finds great joy in blessing people and making life work and helping them walk through the struggles and just experiencing Him. And so grace is getting what I don't deserve. A second definition of grace is this: Christ doing for and in me what I can never do on my own. That Jesus, as God coming in the flesh and living on this earth and dying on the cross and rising again, and now when I trust Him, Jesus does in me and for me what I couldn't do on my own. And that's what we're really going to focus on this morning as we talk about the rules. God's law and just kind of the rules in general and the fact that, you know, I can't keep my own rules. Now, I know you don't struggle with this. But if I wake up this morning and make a determination, I am going to, I don't make it. I do this daily with diet, right? Starting again today until I get the Quick Trip and I want a donut. And then I'll start again tomorrow. I can't keep even my own rules, much less the kind of the law or the rules of God. We're going to deal with this today. I think a lot of us see God as an umpire. Many of you know this. I'm an umpire. I umpire high school and college baseball and softball, and I got my mask and I got my hat and my chest protector and my shin guards and the whole stuff. And I get out there, and my job as an umpire is that I come with an understanding of the rules, and I apply the rules, hopefully fairly, so that one team or the other will win or lose, and so I call strikes, strike, and balls, ball. I call people out, out, and safe, or if it's really close, safe. And every once in a while, I get to do this: you are out of here. You know, that's kind of fun. Not really, because that means somebody is belly aching and whining and they're not happy with you and you're not happy with them. And every once in a while, you'll have a coach come and says, listen, I disagree with you. I don't think you know the rules. And one of the funnest things as an umpire is to be able to start quoting rules and let them know, hey, I do know the rules. You're wrong and I'm right. Brian and I were umpiring one time. It's been 4 or 5 years ago. We were umpiring a ball game and we made this call. And I won't go into detail to explain the call to you because it's really weird and complicated and you wouldn't care anyway, especially all you women. But we made this call, and this coach came running out on the field going, no, 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 you're wrong. That's not the rule. That's not the rule. And Brian and I came over, and we kind of took the guy, and we said, listen, it is the rule. We explained the rule. No, you don't know what you're talking about. You have it all wrong. Listen, no, we don't. This is the rule. We applied it correctly. You are wrong. And finally he said, listen, I am protesting this game. And we said, okay, that's fine. You can do that. And so you had to stop the game. They marked in their little scorebook this protest. And then, you know, he kind of was over to steam and the rest of the game, as we called it. And so, you know, the game went on and ended, and we went on our way. Well, by the grace of God, Brian and I had the same team at the same place. And we were together again, which never happens really. Same team, same place the next week, same day. It was on a Sunday. We came back on the next Sunday and umpired with the same coach. And Brian and I, after the game, we got in the car, we discussed it, and then we opened the rule book just to double check. But we knew we were right. We got the call right. I mean, we were right on it. And so this coach is in the dugout, and he looks up. And when he looks up, he looks at us, and I literally saw him go. And he walks out to the home plate for the pregame conference with his head down and looks at us and goes, okay, you were right. I was wrong. And we said, yeah, we knew that. No big deal, man. Umpire, man, our job was to know the rules, to apply them, to call people safe, to call people out, to call strikes, to call balls. And if somebody really gets out of hand, we throw them out of the game. That's our job. And often this is the way we see God. We think God is about rules. And when he's up there, he's got a mask on, he's got his hat, he's got his equipment, and he can take it. And he's up there calling strikes and calling balls, applying the rules. He knows the rules. And what God's main job is that he is about keeping rules and making sure we don't mess up the rules. And he's kind of pointing it out when we miss it and kind of making us, you know, when we do it right, he's applauding. And God is this big umpire in the sky who's just applying rules. And the struggle or the problem with that is that God does have rules, but This is not the God of the Bible. But all religions end up kind of seeing God this way. In fact, just about every religion on this planet has come up with some system of rules. For example, Islam has five pillars, five basic rules that if you live by, you will kind of meet God halfway. Buddhism has the Eightfold Path. Here's eight basic steps. And if you'll just do the stuff that deals with wisdom and knowledge and experience, the Eightfold Path, and there's eight for them. The Catholic Church has seven sacraments. If you just do these seven basic things and keep this system, you will meet God halfway. I grew up in a religious system that had like 800. Every time I turned around, somebody was coming up with a new rule. I'll never forget, I was in a church, and this church, I was working with teenagers, hanging out with them, and this family came and told us they would donate a pool table to us. We were like, this is cool, man. We can get a pool table, put it down in a youth area, everybody can play pool. We had a couple people forget, oh, no, no pool playing. That was one of their rules. We're like, what? No pool playing? What's wrong with you? Oh, well, there's a bar in town. And people who play pool in the bar smoke and drink, and they end up going home with the wrong person, and we just don't want any of that. And I was like, what does that have to do with pool? People can do that without a pool table, but they had a rule. No pool playing. It's one of the rules. And it was just crazy as I kind of thought, man, how does this do? Well, if you open the Bible, you will find out and study it, you will find out that in the Old Testament, God has, are you ready for this, 613 rules for living. There are 613 laws in the Old Testament that have to do with what type of stuff you can eat. Can't eat catfish, according to the Old Testament rules. About how I'm supposed to live my life, how I'm supposed to clean my house. There's rules about this. What's supposed to happen on the Sabbath, on the day of worship. 613 rules, and they are part of God's revelation in the Bible. But here's the deal. All these rules, all these systems, whether it's the Eightfold Path or the sacraments or the 800 rules in my background, or even trying to go to the Bible and look at these 613 rules in the Bible. Any system that is based on this begins with this assumption. And don't miss this. Here's the assumption. God is here and he did his part. Now I'm here, I do my part. And if I keep my end of the bargain, if I do these five pillars, eightfold path, seven sacraments, 800 rules of the religion I grew up in, the 613 laws in the Old, if I will just do those things, I will meet God in the middle and we'll be okay. But here's the deal. Here's the deal. We never get there. No matter how hard I try. And so then I've got to base it on, well, I keep them, I'm pretty good most of the time. And what ends up happening is that we end up falling in one of two groups. And my guess is you're going to identify with one of these two groups. One of these groups that we end up falling in is the rule followers. These are the rule keepers, rule followers. These are the people who are really working at keeping the rules. I mean, gosh, I got my system, and I've created a system around myself, and I can do this, and I work really hard at it. Teachers, you know these kids in your class. They are the tattletales. They're the ones who keep your rules to a T, and not only do they keep it, they get really nervous when the other kids are not keeping them. And they need to let you know that Johnny is standing in the back of the room screaming at the top of his lungs as if you didn't know that. They're the ones who come in from recess all nervous because everybody was not in line straight. These are the rule keepers, the rule followers. And there, a lot of us, this is how we interact with God. We're rule followers. And God has given us this set of rules, whatever set we've decided for ourselves. And we kind of, our system is one that's kind of doable for us, okay? And as I keep those rules, as I really work hard at it, and I know I mess up sometimes, but I work really hard at it, those rules then become the basis for me to judge everybody. And so if my system is I don't play pool, I see somebody playing pool and I think, oh, those are heathen, bad people. They don't know God and they're just not. But I don't play pool. By gosh, I'm meeting God halfway. Rule keepers. And we're good at this. We come up with sets of rules that fit who I am and what I'm like. And, you know, for example, you know, nerds have rules that fit for them. And we've got this wonderful video to help you feel what it's like to be a rule keeper this morning, okay? As we look at the nerd rules. Got that for us? There it is, the nerd law. I make a system of rules, and now I feel good because I keep the, I'm a rule keeper. And let me tell you how I'm like this, okay? I'm like this in that I want my reputation to be known as somebody who stays within the bounds of the rules. But sometimes when I'm by myself, I'm not quite so concerned about it. I want you to think I stay within the circle of whatever set of rules I have for myself. And I want you to know me as that guy. Just as long as you don't see me in private. See, I'm this guy, okay? And this is what happens for those. Some of you in here, you're understanding what I'm saying. Your life is characterized by the fact that you've got a system, and man, you're working really hard to keep the rules. And when somebody doesn't have your set of rules, you're uneasy and you're uncomfortable, and you kind of characterize people by the set of rules that you've made up for yourself as you're meeting God halfway in the middle point. And people who live, who are rule keepers, okay? And this is what your life is about as you try to interact with God. You end up with a lot of frustration and a lot of guilt. Your life is characterized by the fact that you're frustrated, first of all, by the fact that you can't even keep your own rules. One of these kids is showing up at a movie in his outfit, okay? It's going to happen. And then he's going to go home and he's going to cry about it because he broke his own rules. Frustration, I can't do it. We also are characterized by the fact that we're frustrated with other people who don't keep our rules. And then we're motivated by guilt. And this is a lot of the rule-based religious approaches. This is how they really control people. If I can make you feel guilty, I can motivate you to do all the things that are right. It's amazing how when Jesus interacts with hookers and prostitutes and just vile, weird people in the Bible, and this is kind of who Jesus hung out with. If you study the New Testament and you study Jesus, you find out that Jesus hung out with the wrong people. He went and played pool in pool parlors. You know, he hung out with prostitutes and gamblers and people who were just freaked out. None of them were rule keepers, and all the rule keepers just lost their mind over it. How dare he hang out with those people? They don't keep the rules. Don't you get it? But see, some of us, this is us. But there's some of you, so some of the other half that I'm about to address are in here going, oh, that's not me. I don't deal with that. Because you are a rule breaker. You have come to the, some of you in here, you're like, I'm not a rule keeper. You have come to the point where this is what you did. You went, I can't do it anyway. Forget it. Woohoo! Throw caution to the wind. Party, hearty, cut loose. I am all about freedom. Woohoo! You know, and you feel like your life is characterized by freedom because you are not a rule keeper. You kind of live by your own system and set of rules, but man, you just throw caution to the wind. Anything comes along, you are free and easy. And here's what, if you're a rule breaker, okay, you get angry at the fact that rule keepers are judgmental. But, are you ready for this? Every one of you in here who is a rule breaker, you judge the rule keepers because in your mind, they're legalists and they are not free. And so you pass judgment on them just as much as you think they pass judgment on you because you think they're looking down their nose at you because you just kind of are who you are, free and easy, nobody cares. And I'm going to live my life however I want to, and nobody's going to tell me what to do. And this is kind of where your life is characterized. And you've just thrown caution wind. You might hang out at church. You might do the God thing. But you're almost your way of meeting God in the middle is I'm going to be myself. And people who live in this state, who live in this situation, rule breakers, their lives are really characterized by struggles with addiction and deep brokenness and by anger. Very often, people who just have said, I don't care about the rules, I'm going to do my own thing, end up with a lot of deep hurts and pains and struggles, and they're not really sure where it came from. And in the midst of this, all of this, there is a God who says, rule keepers, you're never going to make it. Rule breakers, throwing caution to the wind isn't the answer. We need to figure out what is, and the answer is grace. This morning, for a few minutes, I want us to look at a passage in the scripture where this guy who is the ultimate rule keeper struggles with the fact that he cannot keep the rules. and this guy who was the ultimate rule keeper interacts with this inner struggle and comes to understand that the only answer is grace. If you have a Bible, turn to Romans chapter 7 this morning. In Romans chapter 7, we're going to be looking at this guy, Paul, as he deals with the struggle of trying to live up to God's standards, trying to meet God halfway. Now, if you don't have a Bible at the end of your row, we have Bibles for you. We would love for you to take one of those. Use that. In that Bible, we will be on page 808 as we look at this passage from this guy whose name was Paul as he writes to us about the struggle. Now, let me give you just a little bit about who this guy is. Paul was part of the Jewish religious group called the Pharisees. And the Pharisees were unbelievable rule keepers. In fact, this is what the Pharisees did. The Pharisees took the 613 laws of the Old Testament, and for every one of those, they added about 10 so that I wouldn't come anywhere near, like, if the law was, remember the Sabbath, like, you know, don't do any work on God's day. They came up with like a whole system of rules that made sure I never got close to don't remember the Sabbath. And so they literally had thousands. I mean, they had books on the rules. And Paul was one of these guys who his whole life was, how good can I be? Can I live my life perfectly by these rules? But he struggled with the fact that I never really made it. And then one day, Jesus, who had died and risen again, appeared to Paul and changed his life. And Paul began to understand that I will never get there. The only hope I have is mercy and grace completely. And so Paul is talking about his struggle, even as somebody who follows Jesus, of looking at the rules and trying to hang in there. And look at this. Chapter 7, we'll begin with verse 7. I'm going to read this whole section. It's a pretty long section, but I'm going to read the whole thing because I think you'll see what he's saying. It really kind of jumps off the page. This is where he goes. What then shall we say then? That the law is sin? By no means. Yet if it had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, you shall not covet. Now he starts, this is part of a long section of a letter he wrote to people who lived in Rome. And he's talking about the law, the rules, these 613 rules. And Paul says, is the law in itself sin? And he says, no. But if it hadn't been for the law, I wouldn't have really known what sin was in my life. Because when I read, don't covet, don't have this weird, passionate desire to have what everybody else has, it wasn't until I read that I understood, dude, I covet all the time. He goes on to say, verse 8, but sin seizing the opportunity through the commandment produced in me all kinds of covetousness. Apart from the law, sin lies dead. I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin came alive and I died. The very commandment that promised life proved to be death to me. For sin, seizing the opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, and though it killed me, so the law is holy and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. Did that which is good then bring death to me? By no means. It was sin producing death in me through what is good in order that sin might be shown to be sin. And though the commandment might become sinful beyond measure. Now, hey, let me just unpack this a little bit for you so you understand what he's saying. Paul is saying, I had all these rules, the 613 rules of the Old Testament. And I either have to determine, are they good or are they bad? And Paul's saying, they are good, but they're not good. I can't do it. And what I've come to realize, Paul says, is I've studied the law, is this. That every time a law arises, it kind of shows me for who I am and pegs me that I can't pull this off. And every time one of these rules I study comes up, I begin to realize that even studying the rule makes me want to do it. It's your two-year-old kid who you say, don't touch the stove. Until you say that, the kid didn't even know it was there. And now this two-year-old's going, I must touch, I must touch. You know, it's like all of life is, I must touch the stove. Why? Because mom said, don't touch it. And what Paul is saying is, this is my life. I was fine until I knew the rule. And then I knew the rule, I tried to keep the rule, but something on the inside of me went, break it, do it, cut loose. And Paul is saying, I struggle with this. This is impossible for me. He goes on. Look at this. Verse 15. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want. Now, the word want there is the strongest word in the original language for desire. This is what he's saying. I don't do what I woke up this morning putting my foot down saying I was going to do. I desire. I made a decision, by gosh, I am going to do this today. And he says, by midday, I don't do it. And verse 16, for second half, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with that the law, that it is good. So it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. Now, I was in college, struggling the same struggle with this guy, Paul. That I grew up in a religious system, and I read the Bible, and I knew the Bible had a lot of things to say to me about the way my life ought to look. And I would make decisions every day. I'm going to do it. And I would wake up, and I'd get halfway into the day, and the thing that I had made a decision I'm going to do, by midday I wasn't doing it. And the things that I had decided I'm not going to do, I was failing at them. And here's what happened. I read this, and I came to understand that this passage was written by the man who wrote almost two-thirds of the New Testament. He's one of the great heroes of the faith. He's a guy who went all over the known world, going from town to town to town, telling people about Jesus. And most of the times he would go into a town, some towns received him, but he got beaten, he got whooped, he got abused. There was a couple times where people literally tried to execute him because he was telling people about God's love and God's grace. He was a guy who was controversial, but he stood for the right things. And here is this great hero going, I wake up and the things that I want to do, I can't pull it off. And this is why this passage, it lit my fire. Because I came to realize that the best guy in the scriptures other than Jesus goes through the same inner turmoil and struggle that I did. And what Paul is trying to help us see is, if I live my life and my basis for knowing God is I'm keeping the rules, fivefold path, seven sacraments, 613 laws, doesn't matter what it is. If I try to say God's done his half, I got to do mine, and I'm going to meet God halfway, I'll never get there because I can't do it. Do you struggle with that? I do. All the time I wrestle with, I cannot do this. I cannot be what I feel like I ought to be. And I want God to like me. And if I can just get there, he'll be okay with me. And Paul says, he goes on to say, verse 18, I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. I do not do the good I want, but the evil I want to do, the evil I do not want to do, I keep on doing it. So if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I, but it is sin that dwells in me. So I find this to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. Do you ever feel that? I delight in the whole law of God and in my inner being. I really do like God's law, what God has said, but I see the members of another law waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Look at verse 24. It's amazing. Wretched man that I am. I mean, here's Paul, the hero. Wretched man that I am. Listen to this phrase. Who will deliver me from this body of death? Now, that's a crazy phrase. And what Paul is doing here is he's taking the reader back to a custom that is 2,000 years old. And he's given a visual, this body of death. In ancient Greece, in some cultures, there was a way of dealing with somebody who had committed a murder. And the way they would sentence a person who had committed a murder is literally they would take the body of the person they murdered and they would tie it and bind it to the person who had done the murder. And that person had to carry that body around. Okay? It's really gross and really disgusting, but what would happen is over a period of days, literally the decay from the dead body would soak into the body of the living person. And that is how they would execute. I know that's gross and weird, but here's an image. Here's what Paul's saying. I am this guy who really loves Jesus, But there's something clinging to me I just can't get rid of, and I don't know what to do with it. And I struggle because if it's based on me, I'll never get there. I've got these desires that just hold on to me. What do I do? And he says, who will deliver me? Who will cut the cords of that off of me and deliver me from this body of death? It's a great image. It's a pretty gross one, but it's a great image as we kind of see. Now, maybe you're here this morning like you're like, oh, no, none of this fits. I'm perfect. You are way better than me. This is my life. This is me going through years of, now I know none of you ever did this, but having a can of Skull and I throw it out the window only to drive, you know, 5 miles down the road and realize I'm broke and have to drive back and go searching along the side of the highway trying to find the stupid thing. Some of you guys do that with cigarettes now. You're like, I'm quitting. Boom. And you get to the next stoplight and you're like, I'm broke. I'm back there. I can't afford to keep throwing these things out the window. This is me promising I am not going to have bacon and eggs for breakfast, and so I have them for lunch and skip breakfast. This is me living in this thing where I resolve. I put my foot down. I'm going to keep the rules. I'm going to meet God halfway. Coming to the realization that I'm at the end of myself and I have nothing to offer. And if it's not grace, I'm doomed. But God gives grace. And what I want to do, just for a few minutes, I want us to deal with how to wrestle with the law. Why did God give us 613 rules? It's 613 rules in the Old Testament that he reduces down to the top 10. You know, David Letterman has top 10, but he was not the first one. God has his top 10 list. We know him as the Ten Commandments. God took the 613, put them into 10. And then in the New Testament, somebody asked Jesus, it says, Jesus, tell us, those 613 laws that got into the top 10, what's the most important one? And Jesus says, listen, there's two. If you keep these two, you'll keep the other 613. Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And so if I just wake up in the morning and I go, okay, this morning, God, I'm going to love you and I'm going to love my neighbor as myself. It lasts until I get in the car and somebody cuts me off. And I really have this deep desire to show them fingers that I shouldn't. I don't want to love those people. I don't, even if I get it down to two. I'm helpless. I have to have grace. Or there's nothing I can do. And that's the story of the Bible. And what I want us to do is just kind of walking through a little bit of this morning. Show you some of the reasons. God tells us in the Word, and even in this passage and a few others. He kind of says, all right, let me explain to you. Here's why I gave you the rules. I'm not an umpire up in heaven going strike, ball. Today you did it, today you didn't. I'm a God of grace. But the rules that I gave you were part of grace because if you didn't have the rules, you wouldn't realize that you needed me. God starts by saying, keep the rules. But always, and we're going to see this in some passages here, God really says, there's a bigger issue. When I gave you rules, it was to show you you're desperate. You need me. And that's it. Okay? And so let me show you just real quick four ways that God's rules kind of point us to our desperate need for grace. And the first one is this, that God's rules reflect God's standard. God's rules reflect God's standard. They show us that God's standard is really above and beyond what we can do. He starts in chapter 7, verse 12. He says this. He says, the law is holy and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. These words, holy, righteous, and good, are words that describe God. Holy means that he is set apart. He is different. He is above us. He is outside us. He is not, you know, just kind of, you know, it's some approaches to spirituality see a God who is the rocks and is the trees and is just kind of intermingled. He is a God who is above and over and outside of his creation. And in his being, he is perfect. Righteous means that there is a standard and he lives up to it. He is the standard and he lives up. Holy, righteous, and good, this inherent good that is just deep, wonderful goodness. And what he's saying is, listen, the law, the rules that God gave, point us to the character of God, who he is. The law is holy and righteous and good. I know this, when I deal with like even the rules, I like to create a set of rules that I can kind of keep and then gather people around me that can kind of keep it like me. I mean, when I play basketball, I don't want to play LeBron James. I want to play guys I can beat. I want to play sports against people that are almost as good as me. But when the night's over, I won. Some people say, you know, lose weight. I think, you know, I just need to find larger friends. People that stand next to me and make me look thinner. Which these lights do wonders for that, don't they? I feel like I see video and I just feel like... Anyway, you know, we like to set systems where you know, we're with people who make us look just a little bit better. Teenagers, you don't want to be in an honors class if you're a C student. You want to be in a class with all the players who have to get tutoring help so they can play football. Right? I mean, so that you are setting the curve. We like this. But what happens is when I stop and I take an honest look at 613 rules, that becomes a top 10 list, it becomes two. Love God, love others. And I take a real good look at that. I come to a deep, profound realization that if I compare myself to God and His standard, I am not there. I'm not there. I'm not what He wants. And here's what most religious systems do. Most religious systems break it down into some keepable things. They will take God's law and they'll just kind of, well, yeah, but we know people can't do that. They need to have a good time. And so they reduce it down to a few things that you can pull off. But even that set doesn't really reflect the great, beautiful, glorious character of God, who is holy and righteous and good. And that is the standard He has set. And I don't live up to that standard. And God showed us the law, gave us the law. In fact, if you read through this passage, I can show you several places in the passage we just read where it says, and this is why the law is there. It shows me I can't. And God is up here, and I can't meet Him halfway. I'm never going to get there. And the second reason that we have the law is this, because God's rules, not only does it reveal God and His character, but God's rules reveal my character. God's rules reveal that I am in desperate need and I can't do this. In verse 7, it says, what shall we say then? That the law is sin? By no means. Yet if we had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had said, you shall not covet. But sin, seizing the opportunity through the commandment, produced in me all kinds of covetousness. Apart from the law, sin lies dead. Now here it is, all right? I am cruising along on the highway. And I haven't paid attention to speed limit. I'm just driving. I'm going 60 miles an hour, having a good old time. I got the radio turned up. I'm having a great time just jamming to some, you know, U2 on the radio on my CD player. Or if you're like me, like KC95 rock and roll. And I'm just having a good old time. But I'm just going my good old merry way. And I pass a speed limit sign that says 70 miles an hour. And what do? I drive 74. Right? Why? Because the sign there showed me what was legal, but it also implied to me in my mind what I could get away with. If I go 78, I might get pulled over. But 74, 75, I mean, that's what traffic's doing. And I wasn't even paying attention to it until I saw the sign. And what did the sign reveal in me? Not that I really want to keep the rules. The sign revealed in me that I want to go as fast as I can get away with. And this is what he's saying. He's saying, listen, here's the speed limit sign. Don't covet. And I see that sign and I go, oh, man, I want that car and I want that woman and I want that TV. And all of a sudden the sign just shows me what's really on the inside of me. It shows me what I'm really like and how, you know, the law, the 613 rules or the two or whatever it is, every time I see one of those, it just really shows in me that when I see the sign, I want to do something that's outside of that. And it really reveals who I honestly am on the inside. And the fact that I need grace. Because if I'm left to myself, I'm going to see the sign and figure out a way around it. Your kids are pros at this. Tell them to do something. And the first 10 minutes after you have told them to do it, they are figuring out how they can get around it and make it look like they did what that you wanted while still doing what they want.
right? And when you give them a law, it really reveals what's on the inside of them. And this is what he's saying. Listen, this is my life. God's rules really do reveal my character. And so this is why Paul comes to the conclusion. Listen, there's nothing good that lives in me. What made him realize that? Trying to keep the rules. When Paul tried to keep this system of rules, he came to the realization, there's nothing good in me. It really revealed his character. The third reason God gives us his rules, his laws, that we have this stuff, is that God's rules reject my effort. I'm going over just a few pages earlier in Romans chapter 3, verse 20. Paul also writing says this. Chapter 3, verse 20. It says, by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. The rules, God's rules, ultimately reject my effort. He says no one is going to be justified. Nobody is going to be made right with God because they kept the rules. Because somewhere I'm going to mess the rules up. And he says nobody will be justified, but it's those rules that give me knowledge or understanding that I sin, that I fail, that I mess up. You know, you come into a house, if you're coming to a new house and, you know, it's empty and there's all these walls and you kind of walk in, you're like, ooh, the walls are nice and, you know, everything is okay, but you're like, I probably need to paint something. And you have this wall, you know, in this room, and it's kind of a white color, and it just looks good, and, you know, the carpet probably needs to be cleaned a little bit. But then you go buy a good white paint, and you paint one wall. What does that white paint do? The other three walls, you turn around, and you're like, oh, my gosh, how did I never see that? And the effort of those other walls to be white is exposed by the whiteness of the fresh paint. This is what the rules do. This is what God's law. It helps us kind of stop and take a real look and go, oh, gosh, my efforts are not real good at this. I need grace. I need God doing for me and in me, Jesus doing for me and in me what I can't do on my own. And so his rules, literally, as I interact with the rules, if I'm a rule keeper, I need to realize it's okay to be a good person. It's okay to not be, you know, a person who just loses their mind and throws caution to the wind. But my effort to meet God halfway is futile. If I'm a rule breaker, it's good to be free. But I still need Jesus to draw me to something that is greater than just living for myself. And grace does all this in my life. This is what grace is. And so God's rules reject my effort. And the last thing is this, that God's rules refers us to Jesus. Galatians chapter 3. Look at this passage. Now, before faith came, we were held captive under the law. Same guy writing. Paul's writing this too. And he says, we were held captive under the law and prisoned until the coming of faith would be revealed. So then, the law was us, our guardian, until Christ came in order that we might be justified by faith. Now, we have a lot of school teachers here. It's kind of cool how we have this culture of school teachers. And I love school teachers. I grew up in a home where they were, both my parents are school teachers. You school teachers will get this. The word guardian there is the Greek word for a school teacher. This is what he's saying. He's saying, listen, when the law, the rules, God's 613 commandments that became the top 10, that became the two, is our school teacher that leads us to Jesus. It's our tutor. It's one that comes alongside of us when I couldn't figure out how to do 2 + 2. Somebody came alongside us and taught us how to do math. It was a school teacher. When I didn't understand science, a school teacher came alongside me and led me to understand this. When I didn't understand some basic skills in education, a school teacher took time and invested in my life to lead me to understanding. This is what he's saying. The law, God's rules. What is a school teacher, a tutor that comes alongside of me, and when I can't figure it out on my own, it begins to lead me to look to Jesus as the only answer for my dilemma. The law is a school teacher. It's a tutor that leads us to Jesus. And God gave us those 613 rules, the top 10, the two biggies, because every one of them shows us, I need Jesus in my life. And here's what Jesus did. Jesus shows up on the scene. God became a man. He hung out on earth. He kept all 613. In fact, Jesus, in his own words in Matthew, says, I didn't come to do away with the rules. I didn't come to do away with the law. I came to fulfill them. And he kept every rule perfectly. And then he died on a cross as a payment for the fact that you and I don't.
God's holiness and goodness and righteousness requires that we keep the rules, but we don't. And somebody, Jesus paid the penalty to bring us into a good standing with God. He died on a cross for you and for me, and he rose 3 days later, and he came back to life to offer grace. To offer to people who are rule keepers but don't ever keep the rules, the reality that you can't meet me halfway, so I'm just going to take care of the whole thing. And to rule breakers who try to live in freedom, but that freedom lives to bondage and struggle, the offer to say, I will pour myself into you and I will change you into the type of person that you could never do on your own. And God gives grace. Amazing, glorious, beautiful, unbelievable grace to do in me and for me what I could never do on my own, giving me what I don't deserve. A friend of mine is a professor and also a vice president at a Christian college in Hannibal. And he was teaching a class. And like any class, he had students in his class that were rule keepers, man. They studied and they were getting A's and they turned in really good papers. And he had people who were blowing a class off and, you know, barely getting by a skin or teeth. They were the rule breakers who, you know, how do I get out of this class? How do I slough off? How do I blow it off? And he came to him, it was time for the final exam, and he came to the study session before, or the class before, and all the students said, listen, give us a study guide. And he said, no study guide. This is a college class. You need to know everything in the book and from the notes. And some of the students are like, oh, Lord, I didn't take a note all semester. What am I going to do? The rule keepers are all like, oh, I got a study set aside. Time, tick, tick, tick. And they had it all set up. They were all excited about, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to study this. I'm going to go out to coffee and have my friends. And we're going to do a study group. And the rule breakers are like, woohoo! I don't even know where my book is. I'm just going to show up and take the test. And the test day shows up, you know, and I mean, he warned them, this is going to be brutal. You need to come prepared. They show up and everybody's sitting in class and the rule keepers, I can do this. I can pull this off. And the rule breakers are like, I hope I don't have Dr. Hufty when I have to take this class again. He starts handing out the test. He puts it on everybody's table and says, listen, I want you to leave it face down until I tell you to go. He's got this stack. It's like thick. These people are starting to sweat bullets, and they're like, oh, my gosh, this is brutal. This test is like a book. And the rule breakers are just dying because they're like, I'm just going to sign my name and turn it in because I know I have no chance. And the rule keeper's like, I didn't study enough for this. And he turns the test over. He tells them to turn the test over. And students begin to look as they just kind of looking. And they look at the first page, and the student is kind of looking around going, what do I do with this? All the answers on page one are filled in. It flips page two. All the answers on page two are filled in. Holy cow, this one kid's like, I got the grading guide. Thank you, Jesus. Page three, get to page four. The essay questions are filled in. He begins to look around, and every student in a room has this weird, perplexed look as they're shuffling through the pages. And he gets to the last page. And Dr. Hufty wrote, this test has been filled in for you. Some of you studied really hard, thinking you could do it on your own, but I made it harder than you could have ever pulled off. Some of you blew it off, and you were in trouble. But today, you have been sitting in my class, and I've been telling you about grace. Today, I wanted you to experience grace. This test has been done for you. You may turn this test in and receive an A. Or you may pick up a copy of one that's not completed on my desk and do it on your own. It's your choice. And gradually, every student, when they got to this page, closed the test, signed the name, placed it on the desk. And here's the deal. God gave us 613 commandments to the top 10 to 2 to say to you, don't care how much you study, you're never going to pull it off. You're sinful people who need grace. And Jesus came and took the test for us. And then says, trust me. Repent. Repent means turn from your own efforts. Rule keepers, Turn from your efforts to keep my rules and trust me. Rule breakers, turn from your rebellion against me and trust me. Repent. Trust me. Repent. And just receive grace in the cross and in Jesus is the answer. God's amazing grace says this. I took the test for you. You can pick up a copy on my desk and do it yourself. Or you can trust me. And as we start Amazing Grace, I want you to see, we're going to start this week and next week by showing why we need grace. I need grace because I really will break the rules of my own. But when I trust Jesus and repent, I begin a journey where God does in me and for me what I could never do on my own. He begins to change me from the inside out, and I begin to experience his goodness. That's the story. We're going to celebrate communion every week of this series because every week it's about Jesus. Grace is always, always, always about Jesus. It is about the fact that he took the test and he died on the cross to pay for the penalty for that. As we celebrate communion, communion is bread, it's juice, it is an image of the body and blood of Jesus. It is for people who have come to a point where they have turned from themselves and they are trusting Jesus. If you're here this morning, you're still kind of interacting with it and struggling with that. I just want to encourage you, use this time to pray. And maybe you need to just repent and trust Jesus for the first time. Just say, I need grace. I try on my own. I just need Jesus. And so this time is a time for you to just to kind of interact with the God who loves you, who pours his grace into you, and to listen to him and respond. If you'd like more questions about that and how you can trust Jesus, I'd love to talk to you after the service. Those of you who have a relationship with God and want to celebrate communion, it'll be down here for you to do that. As the band comes out, they're going to sing a song. Our offering baskets are up here. We collect an offering for those who are part of Genesis. You are free to give. If you're a guest with us, we don't want you or ask you to give anything. This service is our gift to you. But it is for those who are part of our church, a way for us to give back to God because he is so good and he's so gracious. And it's just our way to say, we love you because of your grace. But whatever it is, I hope that this morning, for the next few minutes, you will interact with the God who gives grace and mercy. I'm going to pray. The band's going to sing. You can stand. They're going to sing a song where you can just listen to the words and do communion. And we'll worship. Jesus, we love you. We praise you. Thank you for the morning. Thank you for grace. Thank you for calling us to realize that I can't do it, but you can. And so help us trust you today. In your name I pray. Amen.